downtown New York brokerage house. Sissy's John had gotten him the job through a friend already working there. Francie envied Neely. Each day he crossed the great Williamsburg Bridge and went into the strange big city, while Francie walked to her work on the north side of Brooklyn. And Neely ate in a restaurant. Like Francie, he had brought his lunch the first day, but the boys made fun of him, calling him the country boy from Brooklyn. After that, Mama gave him 15 cents a day for lunch. He told Francie how he ate in a place called the Automat, where you put a nickel in a slot and coffee and cream came out together. Not too little, not too much, just a cupful. Francie wished she could ride across the bridge to work and eat in the Automat instead of carrying sandwiches from home. Neely ran down the L steps. He carried a flat package under his arm. Francie noticed how he put his feet down at an angle so that the whole foot was on the step instead of just the heel part. This gave him sure footing. Papa had always come downstairs that way. Neely wouldn't tell Francie what was in the package, saying that would spoil the surprise. They stopped in a neighborhood bank, which was just about to close for the day, and asked a teller to give them new $1 bills in exchange for their old money.
"What do you want new bills for?" asked the teller.
"It's our first pay, and we'd like to bring it home in new money," explained Francie.
"First pay, eh?" said the teller.
"That takes me back. It certainly takes me back. I remember when I took home my first pay. I was a boy at the time, working on a farm in Manhasset, Long Island. Well, sir..." He went off into a biographical sketch while people in line shuffled impatiently. He ended. "And when I turned my first pay over to my mother, the tears stood in her eyes. Yes, sir, the tears stood in her eyes." He tore the wrapper from a bundle of new bills and exchanged their old money. Then he said, "And here's a present for you." He gave each a fresh minted gold-looking penny, which he took from the cash drawer. "New 1916 pennies," he explained. "The first in the neighborhood. Don't spend them now. Save them." He took two old coppers from his pocket and put them in the drawer to make up the deficiency. Francie thanked him. As they moved away, she heard the man next in line say, as he leaned his elbow on the ledge, "I remember when I brought my first pay home to my old lady." As they went out, Francie wondered whether everyone in line would tell about his first pay. "Everyone who works," said Francie, "has this one thing together. They remember about bringing home their first pay."
"Yeah," agreed Neely.
As they turned a corner, Francie mused, "And the tears stood in her eyes." She had never heard that expression before, and it caught her fancy. "How could that be?" Neely wanted to know. "Tears have no legs. They can't stand." He didn't mean that. He meant it like when people say, "I stood in bed all day." "But stood is no word that way."
"It is so," countered Francie. "Here in Brooklyn, stood is like the past tense of stay."
"I guess so," agreed Neely. "Let's walk down Manhattan Avenue instead of Graham." "Neely, I have an idea. Let's make a tin can bank without telling Mama and nail it in your closet. We'll start it off with these new pennies, and if Mama gives us any spending money, we'll each put 10 cents in every week. We'll open at Christmas and buy presents for Mama and Lori."
"And for us, too," stipulated Neely.
"Yeah, I'll buy one for you, and you buy one for me. I'll tell you what I want when the time comes."
It was agreed.
They walked briskly, outdistancing loitering kids homeward bound from the junk shops. They looked towards Carney's as they passed Skoll Street and noticed the crowd outside of Cheap Charlie's.
"Kids," said Neely contemptuously, jingling some coins in his pockets.
"Remember, Neely, when we used to go out selling junk?"
"That was a long time ago."
"Yeah," agreed Francie. It was, in fact, 2 weeks since they had dragged their last haul to Carney's. Neely presented the flat package to Mama. "For you and Francie," he said. Mama unwrapped it. It was a pound box of Loft's peanut brittle. "And I didn't buy it out of my salary either," explained Neely mysteriously. They made Mama go into the bedroom for a minute. They arranged the 10 new bills on the table, then called Mama out.
"For you, Mama," said Francie with a grand wave of her hand.
"Oh, my," said Mama. "I can hardly believe it."
"And that's not all," said Neely. He took 80 cents in change from his pocket and placed it on the table. "Tips for running errands fast," he explained. "I saved them all week. There was more, but I bought the candy." Mama slid the change across the table to Neely. "All the tips you make, you keep the spending money," she said. "Just like Papa," thought Francie. "Gee, well, I'll give Francie a quarter out of it." "No." Mama got a 50-cent piece from the cracked cup and gave it to Francie. "That's Francie's spending money, 50 cents a week." Francie was pleased. She hadn't expected that much of an allowance. The children overwhelmed their mother with thanks. Katie looked at the candy, at the new bills, and then at her children. She bit her lip, turned suddenly, and went into the bedroom, closing the door after her. "Is she mad about something?" whispered Neely. "No," said Francie. "She's not mad. She just didn't want us to see her start crying."
"How do you know she's going to cry?"
"'Cause when she looked at the money, I saw the tears stood in her eyes." Francie had been working 2 weeks when the layoff came. The girls exchanged looks while the boss explained that it was just for a few days. "A few days is 6 months long," explained Anastasia, for Francie's information. The girls were going over to a Greenpoint factory, which needed hands for winter orders, poinsettias and artificial holly wreaths. When the layoff came there, they'd go on to another factory, and so on. They were Brooklyn migratory workers, following seasonal work from one part of the borough to the other. They urged Francie to go along with them, but she wanted to try new work. She figured that since she had to work, she'd get variety in it by changing her job each chance she got. Then, like the sodas, she could say she had tried every work there was. Katie found an ad in The World that said a file clerk was wanted, beginner considered, age 16, state religion. Francie bought a sheet of writing paper and an envelope for a penny and carefully wrote an application and addressed it to the ad's box number. Although she was only 14, she and her mother agreed that she could pass for 16 easily. So she said she was 16 in the letter. 2 days later, Francie received a reply on an exciting letterhead, a pair of shears lying on a folded newspaper with a pot of paste nearby. It was from the Model Press Clipping Bureau on Canal Street, New York, and it asked Miss Nolan to report for an interview. Sissy went shopping with Francie and helped her buy a grown-up dress and her first pair of high-heeled pumps. When she tried on her new outfit, Mama and Sissy swore that she looked 16 except for her hair. Her braids made her look very kiddish. "Mama, please let me get it bobbed," begged Francie. "It took you 14 years to grow that hair," said Mama, "and I'll not let you have it cut off."
"Gee, Mama, you're way behind the time.
Why do you want short hair like a boy? It would be easier to care for. Taking care of her hair should be a woman's pleasure."
"But Katie," protested Sissy, "all the girls are bobbing their hair nowadays."
"They're fools, then. A woman's hair is her mystery. Daytimes it's pinned up, but at night, alone with her man, the pins come out and it hangs loose like a shining cape. It makes her a special secret woman for the man."
"At night, all cats are gray," said Sissy wickedly.
"None of your remarks," said Katie sharply.
"I'd look just like Irene Castle if I had short hair," persisted Francie. "They make Jew women cut off their hair when they marry, so no other man will look at them. Nuns get their hair cut off to prove they're done with men. Why should any young girl do it when she doesn't have to?"
Francie was about to reply when Mama said, "We'll have no more arguments."
"All right," said Francie, "but when I'm 18, I'll be my own boss. Then you'll see."
"When you're 18, you can shave your scalp for all I care. In the meantime..."
She wound Francie's two heavy braids around her head and pinned them in place with bone hairpins which she took from her own hair. "There," she stepped back and surveyed her daughter. "It looks just like a shining crown," she announced dramatically.
"It does make her look at least 18," conceded Sissy.
Francie looked in the mirror. She was pleased that she looked so old the way Mama had fixed her hair, but she wouldn't give in and say so.
"All my life I'll have headaches carrying this load of hair around," she complained.
"Lucky you, if that's all gives you a life of headaches," said Mama. Next morning, Neely escorted his sister to New York. As the train came onto the Williamsburg Bridge after leaving Marcy Avenue Station, Francie noticed that many people seated in the car rose as if in accord and then sat down again.
Why did they do that, Neely?
Just as you get on the bridge, there's a bank with a big clock. People stand up to look at the time so as they know whether they're early or late for work.
I bet you a million people look at that clock every day, figured Neely.
Francie had anticipated a thrill when she rode over that bridge for the first time. But the ride wasn't half as thrilling as wearing grown-up clothes for the first time. The interview was short. She was hired on trial. Hours, 9 to 5:30, half an hour for lunch, salary, $7 a week to start. First, the boss took her on a tour of inspection of the press clipping bureau. The 10 readers sat at long sloping desks. The newspapers of all the states were divided among them. The papers poured into the bureau every hour of every day from every city in every state of the Union. The girls marked and boxed items sought and put down their total and their own identifying number on the top of the front page. The marked papers were collected and brought to the printer, who had a hand press containing an adjustable date apparatus and racks of slugs before her. She adjusted the paper's date on her press, inserted the slug containing the name, city, and state of the newspaper, and printed as many slips as there were items marked. Then slips and newspaper went to the cutter, who stood before a large slanting desk, and slashed out the marked items with a sharp curved knife. In spite of the letterhead, there wasn't a pair of shears on the premises. As the cutter slashed out the items, throwing the discarded paper to the floor, a sea of newspaper rose as high as her waist each 15 minutes. A man collected this waste paper and took it away for baling. The clipped items and slips were turned over to the paster, who affixed the clippings to the slips. Then they were filed, collected, and placed in envelopes and mailed. Francie got onto the filing system very easily. In 2 weeks, she had memorized the 2,000 or so names or headings on the file box. Then she was put into training as a reader. For 2 more weeks, she did nothing but study the client's cards, which were more detailed than the file box headings. When an informal examination proved that she had memorized the orders, she was given the Oklahoma papers to read. The boss went over her papers before they went to the cutter and pointed out her mistakes. When she got expert enough not to need checking, the Pennsylvania papers were added. Soon after, she was given the New York state papers and now had 3 states to read. By the end of August, she was reading more papers and marking more items than any other reader in the bureau. She was fresh to the work, anxious to please, had strong, clear eyes — she was the only reader not wearing glasses — and had developed a photographic eye very quickly. She could take in an item at a glance and note immediately whether it was something to mark. She read between 180 and 200 newspapers a day. The next best reader averaged from 100 to 110 papers. Yes, Francie was the fastest reader in the bureau, and the poorest paid. Although she had been raised to $10 a week when she went on reading, her runner-up received $25 a week, and the other readers received $20. Since Francie never became friendly enough with the girls to be taken into their confidence, she had no way of knowing how grossly underpaid she was. Although Francie liked reading newspapers and was proud to earn $10 a week, she was not happy. She had been excited about going to work in New York. Since such a tiny thing as a flower in a brown bowl at the library had thrilled her so, she expected that the great city of New York would thrill her 100 times more. But it was not so. The bridge had been the first disappointment. Looking at it from the roof of her house, she had thought that crossing it would make her feel like a gossamer-winged fairy flying through the air. But the actual ride over the bridge was no different than the ride above the Brooklyn streets. The bridge was paved in sidewalks and traffic roads like the streets of Broadway, and the tracks were the same tracks. There was no different feeling about the train as it went over the bridge. New York was disappointing. The buildings were higher and the crowds thicker. Otherwise, it was little different from Brooklyn. From now on, would all new things be disappointing? She wondered. She had often studied the map of the United States and crossed its plains, mountains, deserts, and rivers in her imagination. And it had seemed a wonderful thing. Now she wondered whether she wouldn't be disappointed in that, too. Supposing she thought she was to walk across this great country. She'd start out at 7 in the morning, say, and walk westward. She'd put 1 foot down in front of the other to cover distance, and as she walked to the west, she'd be so busy with her feet and with the realization that her footsteps were part of a chain that had started in Brooklyn that she might think nothing at all of the mountains, rivers, plains, and deserts she came upon. All she'd notice was that some things were strange because they reminded her of Brooklyn, and that other things were strange because they were so different from Brooklyn. "I guess there is nothing new, then, in the world," decided Francie unhappily.
If there is anything you were different, some part of it must be in Brooklyn, and I must be used to it and wouldn't be able to notice it if I came across it.
Like Alexander the Great, Francie grieved, being convinced that there were no new worlds to conquer. She adapted herself to the split-second rhythm of the New Yorker going to and from work. Getting to the office was a nervous ordeal. If she arrived 1 minute before 9, she was a free person. If she arrived a minute after, she worried because that made her the logical scapegoat of the boss, if he happened to be in a bad mood that day. So she learned ways of conserving bits of seconds. Long before the train ground to a stop at her station, she pushed her way to the door to be one of the first expelled when it slid open. Out of the train, she ran like a deer, circling the crowd to be the first up the stairs leading to the street. Walking to the office, she kept close to the building so she could turn corners sharply. She crossed streets kitty-corner to save stepping off and on an extra pair of curbs. At the building, she shoved her way into the elevator, even though the operator yelled, "Car's full!" and all this maneuvering to arrive 1 minute before instead of after 9. Once she left home 10 minutes earlier to have more time. In spite of no need of hurry, she still pushed her way out of the train, flew up the steps, rushed through the streets economically, and crowded into a full elevator. She was 15 minutes early. The big room was echoingly empty, and she felt desolate and lost. When the other workers rushed in seconds before 9, Francie felt like a traitor. The next morning she slept 10 minutes longer and returned to her original timing. She was the only Brooklyn girl in the bureau. The others came from Manhattan, Hoboken, the Bronx, and one commuted from Bayonne, New Jersey. Two of the oldest readers there, sisters, had originally come from Ohio. The first day Francie worked at the bureau, one of the sisters said to her, "You have a Brooklyn accent." It had sounded like a shocked accusation and made Francie self-conscious of her speech. She took to pronouncing words carefully, lest she say things like goyle for girl and apparentment instead of appointment. There were but two people in the bureau to whom she could talk without embarrassment. One was the boss manager. He was a Harvard graduate, and in spite of a broad A which he used indiscriminately, his speech was plain and his vocabulary less affected than those of the readers, most of whom had graduated from high school and had picked up an extensive vocabulary from years of reading. The other person was Miss Armstrong, who was the only other college graduate. Miss Armstrong was the special city reader. Her desk was isolated in the choicest corner of the room, where there was a north and an east window, the best light for reading. She read nothing but the Chicago, Boston, Philadelphia, and New York City newspapers. A special messenger brought her each edition of the New York City newspaper soon after it left the presses. When her papers were read up, she didn't have to pitch in, as the other readers did, and help the girls who were behind. She crocheted or manicured her nails while waiting for the next edition. She was the highest paid, receiving $30 a week. Miss Armstrong was a kindly person, and she took a helpful interest in Francie and tried to draw her out in conversation so that she wouldn't feel lonely. Once in the washroom, Francie overheard a remark about Miss Armstrong being the boss's mistress. Francie had heard of but never seen one of those fabulous beings. Immediately she examined Miss Armstrong closely as a mistress. She saw that Miss Armstrong wasn't pretty. Her face was almost simian, with its wide mouth and flat, thick nostrils, and her figure was merely passable. Francie looked at her legs. They were long, slender, and exquisitely molded. She wore the sheerest of flawless silk stockings, and expensively made high-heeled pumps shot her beautifully arched feet. "Beautiful legs, then, is the secret of being a mistress," concluded Francie. She looked down at her own long, thin legs. "I'll never make it, I guess." Sighing, she resigned herself to a sinless life. There was a class system in the bureau, engendered by the cutter, printer, paster, paper baler, and delivery boy. These workers, illiterate but sharp-witted, who for some reason called themselves the club, assumed that the better-educated readers looked down on them. In retaliation, they stirred up as much trouble as possible among the readers. Francie's loyalties were divided. By background and education, she belonged to the club class, but by ability and intelligence, she belonged to the readers' class. The club was shrewd enough to feel this division in Francie and tried to use her as a go-between. They informed her of troublemaking office rumors, expecting that she would relay them to the readers and create dissension. But Francie wasn't friendly enough with the readers to exchange gossip with them, and the rumors died with her. So one day, when the cutter told her that Miss Armstrong was leaving in September, and that she, Francie, was to be promoted to the city reader job, Francie assumed this to be a rumor invented to arouse jealousy among the readers, all of whom expected the city reading job when and if Miss Armstrong resigned. She thought it was preposterous that she, a girl of 14, with nothing but a grade school education, would be considered eligible to take over the work of a 30-year-old college graduate like Miss Armstrong. It was nearing the end of August, and Francie was worried because Mama hadn't mentioned anything about her going to high school. She wanted desperately to go back to school. All the years of talk about higher education she had heard from her mother, grandmother, and aunts not only made her anxious to get more education, but gave her an inferiority complex about her present lack of education. She remembered with affection the girls who had written in her autograph book. She wanted to be one of them again. They came out of the same life as she did. They were no further along. Her natural place was going to school with them, not working competitively with older women. She didn't like working in New York. The crowds continually swarming about her made her tremble. She felt that she was being pushed into a way of life that she wasn't ready to handle. And the things she dreaded worst about working in New York was the crowded L trains. There had been that time in the train when, hanging from a strap and so tightly wedged in the crowd that she couldn't so much as lower her arm, she had felt a man's hand. No matter how she twisted and squirmed, she couldn't get away from that hand. When she swayed with the crowd as the car swerved, the hand tightened. She was unable to twist her head to see whose hand it was. She stood in desperate futility, helplessly enduring the indignity. She could have called out and protested, but she was too ashamed to call public attention to her predicament. It seemed an eternity before the crowd thinned out enough for her to move to a different part of the car. After that, standing in a crowded train became a dreaded ordeal. One Sunday, when she and Mama brought Laurie over to see Grandma, Francie told Sissy about the man on the train, expecting that Sissy would comfort her. But her aunt treated it as a great joke. "So a man pinched you on the L," she said. "I wouldn't let that bother me. It means you get in a good shape, and there are some men who can't resist a woman's shape." "Say, I must be getting old. It's been years since anybody pinched me on the L." "There was a time when I couldn't ride in a crowd without coming home black and blue," she said proudly. "Is that anything to brag about?" asked Katie. Sissy ignored that remark. "The day will come, Francie," she said, "when you're 45 and have a shape like a bag of horses' oats tied in the middle. Then you'll look back and long for the old days when men wanted to pinch you." "If she does look back," said Katie, "it will be because you put it in her mind and not because it's anything wonderful to remember." She turned to Francie. "As for you, learn to stand in the train without holding on to a strap. Keep your hands down and keep a long, sharp pin in your pocket. If you feel a man's hand on you, stick it good with the pin." Francie did as Mama said. She learned to keep her feet without holding to a strap. She kept her hand closed on a long, vicious pin in her coat pocket. She hoped someone would pinch her again. She just hoped so, so that she could stab him with the pin. "It's all very well for Sissy to talk about shapes and men, but I don't like to be pinched in the back. And when I get to be 45, I certainly hope that I have something nicer to look back on and long for than being pinched by a stranger. Sissy ought to be ashamed." "What's the matter with me, anyhow? Here I stand criticizing Sissy. Sissy, who's been so darn good to me. I'm dissatisfied with my job when I should feel lucky having such interesting work. Imagine getting paid to read when I like to read so much anyhow. And everyone thinks New York is the most wonderful city in the world. And I can't even get to like New York. Seems like I'm the most dissatisfied person in the whole world. Oh, I wish I was young again, when everything seemed so wonderful." Just before Labor Day, the boss called Francie into his private office and informed her that Miss Armstrong was leaving to be married. He cleared his throat and added that Miss Armstrong was marrying him, in fact. Francie's conception of a mistress broke and scattered. She had believed that men never married their mistresses, that they cast them aside like worn-out gloves. So Miss Armstrong was to become a wife instead of a worn-out glove. Well. "So we'll need a new city reader," the boss was saying. "Miss Armstrong herself suggested that we, try you out, Miss Nolan." Francie's heart jumped. She, city reader, the most coveted job in the bureau. There had been truth, then, in the club's rumors. Another preconceived idea gone. She had always assumed that all rumors were false. The boss planned to offer her $15 a week, figuring he'd get as good a reader as his future wife at half the salary.
The girl should be tickled to death, too, a youngster like that. 15 a week. She said she was past 16. She looked 13. Of course, her age was none of his business as long as she was competent. The law couldn't touch him, hiring someone underage. All he'd have to say was that she deceived him as to her true age. "There's a little raise along with the job," he said benignly. Francie smiled happily, and he worried. "Have I put my foot in it?" he thought. "Maybe she didn't expect a raise." He covered his blunder hastily. "A small raise, after we see how you work out."
"I don't know," began Francie doubtfully.
"She's over 16," decided the boss, "and she's going to hold me up for a big raise. To forestall her," he said, "we'll give you 15 a week, starting." He hesitated. No use being too good-natured. "Starting the 1st of October." He leaned back in his chair, feeling as gracious as God himself.
"I mean, I don't think I'll be here much longer."
"She's working me for more money," he thought. Aloud, he asked, "Why not?"
"I'm going back to school after Labor Day, I think. I meant to tell you as soon as my plans were settled."
"College?"
"High school."
"I'll have to put Pinsky on City," he thought. "She's getting 25 now. She'll expect 30, and I'm right back where I started. This Nolan is better than Pinsky, too. Damn Irma. Where does she get the idea that a woman shouldn't work after marriage? She could keep right on, keep the money in the family, buy a home with it." He spoke to Francie.
"Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. Not that I don't approve of higher education, but I consider newspaper reading a darn fine education. It's a good, live, ever-growing, contemporary education. While in school, it's merely books."
"Dead books," he said contemptuously.
I'll have to talk it over with my mother."
"By all means, tell her what your boss said about education. And tell her I said," he closed his eyes and took the plunge, "that we'll pay you $20 a week, starting the 1st of November. He shaved off a month.
"That's an awful lot of money," she said in all honesty.
"We believe in paying our workers well so they stick with us, and, Miss Nolan, please don't mention your future salary. It's more than anyone else is getting," he lied. "And if they found out..." He spread his hands in a gesture of futility. "You understand? No washroom gossip." Francie felt gracious as she set his mind at ease by assuring him that she'd never betray him in the washroom. The boss started to sign letters, indicating that the interview was over. "That's all, Miss Nolan, and we must have your decision the day after Labor Day."
"Yes, sir." $20 a week. Francie was stunned. 2 months ago, she was glad to earn $5 a week. Uncle Willie only earned 18 a week, and he was 40. Sissy's John was smart and earned but $22.50 a week. Few men in her neighborhood earned as much as 20 a week, and they had families, too. "With that money, our troubles would be over," thought Francie. "We could pay rent on a 3-room flat somewhere. Mama wouldn't have to go out to work, and Lori wouldn't be left alone so much. I guess I'd be mighty important if I could manage something like that." "But I want to go back to school."
She recalled the constant harping on education in the family. "Grandma, it will raise you up on the face of the earth. Evie, each of my 3 children will get 3 diplomas. Sissy, and when Mother goes, pray God not for a long time yet, and Baby is big enough to start kindergarten, I'm going out to work again, and I'll bank my pay, and when little Sissy grows up, I'll put her in the best college there is. Mama, and I don't want my children to have the same hard-working life I have. Education will fix it so that their lives are easier."
"Still, it's such a good job," thought Francie. "That is, good right now. But my eyes will get worn out from the work. All the older readers have to wear glasses. Miss Armstrong said a reader's only good as long as her eyes hold out. Those other readers were fast, too, when they first started, like me. But now their eyes. I must save my eyes, not read away from the job. If Mama knew I could get 20 a week, maybe she wouldn't send me back to school and I couldn't blame her. We've been poor so long. Mama is very fair in all things, but this money might make her see things in a different way, and it wouldn't be her fault. I won't tell her about the raise until after she decides about school." Francie spoke to Mama about school, and Mama said yes, they'd have to talk about it. They'd talk about it right after supper that night. After finishing their supper coffee, Katie announced needlessly, since everybody knew it, that school was opening next week. I want both of you to go to high school, but it's working out that only one of you can start this fall. I'm saving every cent I can out of your pay so that next year both of you will be back in school. She waited. She waited a long time. Neither of the children answered. Well, don't you want to go to high school? Francie's lips were stiff as she spoke. So much depended on Mama, and Francie wanted her words to make a good impression. Yes, Mama. I want to go back to school more than I'll ever want anything in my life. I don't want to go, said Neely. Don't make me go back to school, Mama. I like to work, and I'm going to get a $2 raise the first of the year. Don't you want to be a doctor? No, I want to be a broker and make lots of money like my bosses. I'll get onto the stock market and make $1 million someday. My son will be a great doctor. How do you know? I might turn out like Dr. Huler on Mauer Street with an office and a basement flat and always wear a dirty shirt like him. Anyhow, I know enough. I don't need to go back to school. Neely doesn't want to go back to school, said Katie. She spoke to Francie almost pleadingly. You know what that means, Francie. Francie bit her lip. It wouldn't do to cry. She must keep calm. She must keep thinking clearly. It means, said Mama, that Neely has to go back to school.
I won't, cried Neely. I won't go back no matter what you say. I'm working and earning money, and I want to keep on. I'm somebody now with the fellas. If I go back to school, I'm just a punk kid again. Besides, you need my money, Mama. We don't want to be poor again.
You'll go back to school, announced Katie quietly. Francie's money will be enough.
Why do you make him go when he doesn't want to? Cried Francie, and keep me out of school when I want to go so much.
Yeah, agreed Neely. Because if I don't make him, he'll never go back, said Mama. Where you, Francie, will fight and manage to get back somehow.
Why are you so sure all the time? Protested Francie. In a year I'll be too old to go back. Neely's only 13. He'll still be young enough next year.
Nonsense. You'll only be 15 next fall.
17, corrected Francie. Going on 18. Too old to start. What kind of silly talk is that?
Not silly. On the job, I'm 16. I have to look and act 16 instead of 14. Next year, I'll be 15 in years, but 2 years older in the way I'm living. Too old to change back into a schoolgirl.
Neely will go back to school next week, said Katie stubbornly. And Francie will go back next year.
I hate both of you, shouted Neely. And if you make me go back, I'll run away from home. Yes, I will.
He ran out, slamming the door. Katie's face set in lines of misery, and Francie felt sorry for her.
Don't worry, Mama. He won't run away. He just said that.
The instant relief that came into her mother's face angered Francie. But I'm the one who'll go away, and I won't make a speech about it. When the time comes that you don't need what I earn, I'll leave.
What's gotten into my children, who used to be so good? Asked Katie poignantly.
Years have gotten into us. Katie looked puzzled. Francie explained. We never did get working papers.
But they were hard to get. The priest wanted a dollar for each baptismal certificate, and I would have had to go to City Hall with you. I was nursing Lori every 2 hours then, and couldn't go. We all figured it was easier for you both to claim to be 16 and not have all the fuss.
That part was all right. But saying we were 16, we had to be 16, and you treat us like 13-year-old children.
I wish your father were here. He understood things about you that I can't get to understand.
Pain stabbed through Francie. After it passed, she told her mother that her salary was to be doubled on November 1st.
$20.
Katie's mouth fell open in surprise.
Oh, my.
That was her usual expression when anything astonished her.
When did you know?
Saturday.
And you didn't tell me till now?
No.
You thought if I knew that it would fix my mind about you keeping on working?
Yes.
But I didn't know when I said it was right for Neely to go back to school. You can see that I did what I thought was right, and the money didn't come into it.
Can't you see?
She asked pleadingly.
No, I can't see. I can only see that you favor Neely more than me. You fix everything for him and tell me that I can find a way myself. Someday I'll fool you, Mama. I'll do what I think is right for me, and it might not be right in your way.
I'm not worrying, because I know that I can trust my daughter. Katie spoke with such simple dignity that Francie was ashamed of herself. And I trust my son. He's mad now about doing what he doesn't want to do. But he'll get over it and do well in school. Neely's a good boy.
Yes, he's a good boy, conceded Francie. But even if he was bad, you wouldn't notice it. But where I'm concerned...
Her voice went ragged on a sob. Katie sighed sharply, but said nothing. She got up and started to clear the table. Her hand reached for a cup, and Francie, for the first time in her life, saw her mother's hand fumble. It trembled and couldn't connect with the cup. Francie put the cup in her mother's hand. She noticed a big crack in the cup. Our family used to be like a strong cup, thought Francie. It was whole and sound and held things well. When Papa died, the first crack came, and this fight tonight made another crack. Soon there will be so many cracks that the cup will break, and we'll all be pieces instead of a whole thing together. I don't want this to happen, yet I'm deliberately making a deep crack. Her sharp sigh was just like Katie's. The mother went to the wash basket, in which the baby was sleeping peacefully in spite of the bitter talking. Francie saw her mother's still fumbling hands take the sleeping child from the basket. Katie sat in her rocker near the window, held her baby tightly, and rocked. Francie almost went blind with pity. I shouldn't be so mean to her, she thought. What has she ever had but hard work and trouble? Now she has to turn to her baby for comfort. Maybe she's thinking that Laurie, whom she loves so, and who is so dependent on her now, will grow up to turn against her like I'm doing now. She put her hand awkwardly on her mother's cheek.
It's all right, Mama. I didn't mean it. You're right, and I'll do as you say. Neely must go to school, and you and I will see that he gets through.
Katie put her hand over Francie's.
That's my good girl, she said. Don't be mad at me, Mama, because I fought you. You yourself taught me to fight for what I thought was right, and I thought I was right.
I know. And I'm pleased that you can and will fight for what you should have, and you'll always come out all right,
no matter what.
You're like me that way.
And that's where the whole trouble is, thought Francie. We're too much alike to understand each other because we don't even understand our own selves. Papa and I were two different persons, and we understood each other. Mama understands Neely because he's different from her. I wish I was different in the way that Neely is. Then everything's all right now between us?
Katie asked with a smile.
Of course.
Francie smiled back and kissed her mother's cheek. But in their secret hearts, each knew that it wasn't all right, and would never be all right between them again. Christmas again, but this year there was money for presents, and lots of food in the icebox, and the flat was always warm now. When Francie came in off the cold street, she thought that the warmth was like a lover's arms around her, drawing her into the room. She wondered, incidentally, exactly what a lover's arms felt like. Francie took comfort out of not returning to school in the realization that the money she earned made life easier for them. Mama had been very fair. When Francie was raised to $20 a week, Mama gave her $5 a week for herself to pay for her car fare, lunches, and clothes. Also, Katie deposited $5 each week in Francie's name in the Williamsburg Savings Bank for college, she explained. Katie managed well on the remaining $10 and a dollar that Neely contributed.
It wasn't a fortune, but things were cheap in 1916, and the Nolans got along fine. Neely had taken to school cheerfully when he found that many of his old gang were entering Eastern District High. He had his old after-school job back at McGarity's, and Mama gave him one of the $2 for pocket money. He was somebody in school. He had more spending money than most boys, and he knew Julius Caesar backwards, forwards, and upside down. When they opened the tin can bank, there was nearly $4 in it. Neely added another dollar, and Francie five, and they had $10 to spend for Christmas presents. The three of them went shopping the afternoon before Christmas, taking Laurie with them. First they went to buy Mama a new hat. In the hat store they stood behind Mama's chair while she held the baby in her lap and tried on hats. Francie wanted her to have a jade green velvet one, but there wasn't a hat of that color to be found in Williamsburg. Mama thought she ought to get a black hat. "We're buying the hat, not you," Francie told her, "and we say no more mourning hats." "Try on this red one, Mama," suggested Neely. "No, I'll try on that very dark green one in the window."
"It's a new shade," said the woman proprietor, getting it out of the window. "We call it moss green."
She set it straight on Katie's brow. With an impatient flick of her hand, Katie tilted the hat over one eye.
"That's it," declared Neely.
"Mama, you look beautiful," was Francie's verdict.
"I like it," decided Mama.
"How much?" she asked the woman. The woman drew a long breath, and the Nolans girded themselves for bargaining.
"It's like this," began the woman.
"How much?" repeated Katie inflexibly.
"In New York, $10 would you pay for the same merchandise, but..."
"If I wanted to pay $10, I'd go to New York for a hat."
"Is that a way to talk? Exact copy, same hat in Wanamaker's is $7.50.
Pregnant pause.
"I'm going to give you identical hat for $5.
"I have exactly $2 to spend on a hat. Get out from my store," shouted the woman dramatically.
"All right." Katie gathered up the baby and got to her feet.
"You must be so hasty."
The woman pushed her back into the chair. She thrust the hat into a paper bag.
"I'm letting you take it home for $4.50. Believe me, my own mother-in-law shouldn't have it for that price."
"I believe you," thought Katie, "especially if she's like my mother-in-law." Aloud she said, "The hat's nice, but I can only afford $2. There are lots of other hat stores, and I ought to get one for that. Not as good as this one, but good enough to keep the wind off my head."
"I want you should listen."
The woman made her voice deep and sincere.
"They say that by the Jews, money is everything. By me, is different. When I got a pretty hat, and it goes with a pretty customer, something happens to me here." She put her hand on her heart. "I get so... profits is nothing. I give free."
She pushed the bag into Katie's hand.
"Take the hat for $4. That's what it cost me wholesale." She sighed. "Believe me, a businesswoman I shouldn't be. Better I should be a picture painter."
And the bargaining went on. Katie knew when the price finally reached $2.50, the woman wouldn't go lower. She tested her by pretending she was leaving, but this time the woman made no attempt to stop her. Francie nodded to Neely. He gave the woman $2.50.
"You shouldn't tell nobody how cheap you got it," warned the woman.
"We won't," promised Francie. "Put the hat in a box."
10 cents extra is a box, what it cost me wholesale.
"A bag's good enough," protested Katie.
"This is your Christmas present," said Francie, "and it goes in a box." Neely got out another dime. The hat was wrapped in tissue and put in a box.
"I give it to you so cheap, you should come back next time you buy a hat. But don't expect such bargains next time."
Katie laughed. As they left, the woman said,
"Wear it in good health."
"Thank you."
As the door closed on them, the woman whispered bitterly,
"Goyim!"
and spat after them. On the street, Neely said, "No wonder Mama waits 5 years to buy a new hat, if it's all that trouble."
"Trouble?" said Francie. "Why, that's fun."
Next they went to Siegler's to buy a sweater suit for Laurie's Christmas. When Siegler saw Francie, he let loose a flood of abuse.
"So, at last you come in mine store? Is something, maybe, other dry goods stores ain't got, and you come by me?
Maybe by other store is Dickie Penny cheaper but damaged stock. No? He turned to Katie and explained. So many years comes this girl by me to buy Dickies and paper collars for the papa. Now for a whole year already, she don't come.
Her father died a year ago, explained Katie. Mr. Siegler gave his forehead a mighty blow with the flat of his hand.
Oi, by me is so big the mouth, so my foot always goes in,
he apologized.
That's all right, said Katie soothingly. It's this way by me. Nobody tells me nothing, and I don't know till now.
That's the way it always is, said Katie.
And now, he asked briskly, getting down to business, what can I show you?
A sweater suit for a 7-month-old baby.
I got here exactle size.
He took a blue wool outfit from a box, but when they held it up to Lori, the sweater reached only to her navel, and the leggings went to just below her knees. They measured other sizes and found a 2-year-old size that was just right. Mr. Siegler went into ecstasies.
I'm in dry goods business 20 years. 15 on Grand Street and 5 on Graham Amir. And never in sleepin' do I see a 7 months so big.
And the Nolans glowed with pride. There was no bargaining because Siegler's was a one-price store. Neely counted out $3. They put the suit on the baby then and there. She looked cute with the zitful cap pulled down over her ears. The bright blue color brought out the rosiness of her skin. You'd think she understood the way she acted so pleased, flashing her 2-toothed smile about indiscriminately.
Ach, du Liebchen,
crooned Siegler, hands clasped prayerfully.
She should wear it in good health.
This time the wish was not nullified by his spitting after them. Mama went home with the baby and her new hat, while Neely and Francie continued their Christmas shopping. They bought small gifts for their Flipman cousins and something for Sissy's baby. Then it was time for their own gifts.
I'll tell you what I want, and you can buy it for me, said Neely.
All right. What?
Spats.
Spats? Francie's voice scaled up.
Pale gray ones, he said firmly.
That's what you want, she began dubiously.
Medium size.
How do you know the size?
I went in and tried them on yesterday.
He gave Francie $1.50, and she bought the spats. She had the man wrap them in a gift box. On the street, she presented the package to Neely while they frowned solemnly at each other.
From me to you, Merry Christmas, said Francie.
Thank you, he replied formally. And now, what do you want?
A black lace dance set in the window of that store near Union Avenue.
Is that lady stuff? Asked Neely uneasily.
Uh-huh. 24 waist and 32 bust. $2.
You buy it. I don't like to ask for anything like that. She bought the coveted dance set, panties and brassiere made of scraps of black lace, held together by narrow black satin ribbon.
Neely disapproved and muttered an ungracious,
You're welcome, to her thanks.
They passed the Christmas tree curb market.
Remember the time, said Neely, when we let the man chuck the biggest tree at us?
Do I? Every time I get a headache, it's in the place where the tree hit me.
And the way Papa sang when he helped us get the tree up the stairs, recalled Neely.
Several times that day, the name or thought of Papa had come up, and each time Francie had felt a flash of tenderness instead of the old stab of pain.
Am I forgetting him? She thought. In times to come, will it be hard to remember anything about him?
I guess it's like Grandma Mary Romilly says, "Vis time passes all."
The first year was hard because we could say last election he voted, last Thanksgiving he ate with us, but next year it will be 2 years ago that he... And as time passes, it will be harder and harder to remember and keep track.
Look, Neely grabbed her arm and pointed to a 2-foot fir tree in a wooden tub.
It's growing, she cried out.
What did you think?
They all have to grow in the beginning.
I know. Still and all, you always see them cut off and get the idea that they grow chopped down.
Let's buy it, Neely.
It's awful little.
But it has roots.
When they brought it home, Katie examined the tree and the line between her eyes deepened as she figured something out.
Yes, she said. After Christmas, we'll put it on the fire escape and see that it gets sun and water, and once a month, horse manure.
No, Mama, protested Francie. You're not going to put that horse manure over on us.
As small children, gathering horse manure had been one of their most dreaded chores. Grandma Mary Romilly kept a row of scarlet geraniums on her windowsill, and they were strong and bright and clear-colored, because once a month either Francie or Neely had to go out on the streets with the cigar box and fill it with two neat rows of manure balls. On delivery, Grandma made payment of 2 cents. Francie had been ashamed to gather horse manure. Once she had protested to Grandma, who had answered,
"Aye, the blood runs thin in the third generation. Back in Austria, my good brothers loaded large wagons with the manure, and they were strong and honorable men."
They'd have to be, Francie had thought, to work with stuff like that. Katie was saying, "Now that we own a tree, we have to take care of it and make it grow. You can get manure in the dark of night if you're ashamed." "There's so few horses now, mostly automobiles. It's hard to get," argued Neely.
"Go on a cobblestone street where autos don't go, and if there isn't any manure, wait for a horse and follow him until there is."
"Gee whiz," protested Neely. "I'm sorry we ever bought the old tree."
"What's the matter with us?" said Francie. "These aren't olden times. We've got money now.
All we have to do is give some old kid on the block a nickel, and he'll collect it for us."
"Yeah," agreed Neely, relieved.
"I should think," said Mama, "that you'd want to take care of your tree with your own hands."
"The difference between rich and poor," said Francie, "is that the poor do everything with their own hands, and the rich hire hands to do things. We're not poor anymore. We can pay to have some things done for us."
"I want to stay poor then," said Katie, "because I like to use my hands."
Neely, as always, became bored when his mother and sister began one of their figuring-out conversations. To change the subject, he said,
"I bet Lori's as big as that tree."
They fished the baby out of her basket and measured her against the tree.
"Exactly the same height," said Francie, imitating Mr. Siegler.
"I wonder which will grow the fastest," said Neely.
"Neely, we've never had a puppy or a kitten, so let's make a pet out of the tree."
Tree can't be a pet."
"Why can't it? It lives and breathes, doesn't it?
We'll give it a name. Annie. The tree's Annie and the baby's Lori, and together they're the song."
"You know what?" asked Neely.
"No, what?"
"You're crazy, that's what."
"I know it. And isn't it wonderful? Today I don't feel like Miss Nolan, supposed to be 17, and head reader of the Model Press Clipping Bureau. It's like olden times when I had to let you carry the junk money. I feel just like a kid."
"And you are," said Katie. "A kid just turned 15.
"Yeah? You won't think so when you see what Neely bought me for Christmas."
"What you made me buy you," corrected Neely. "Show Mama what you made me buy you for Christmas, smarty. Just go and show her," urged Francie.
When he showed Mama, her voice scaled up like Francie's when she said,
"Spats?"
"Just to keep my ankles warm," explained Neely. Francie showed her dance set, and Mama let loose her,
"Oh, my," of astonishment.
"Do you think that's what fast women wear?" asked Francie hopefully.
"If they do, I'm sure they all come down with pneumonia. Now let's see. What'll we have for supper?"
"Aren't you going to object?" Francie was disappointed because Mama wasn't making a fuss.
"No.
All women go through a black lace drawers time. You came to it earlier than most, and you'll get over it sooner. I think we'll heat up the soup and have that and soup meat and potatoes."
"Mama thinks she knows everything," thought Francie resentfully.
They attended Mass together Christmas morning. Katie was having a prayer said for the repose of Johnny's soul. She looked very pretty in her new hat. The baby looked nice, too, in her new outfit. Neely, wearing his new spats, manfully insisted on carrying the baby. As they passed Stag Street, some boys hanging out in front of a candy store hooted at Neely. His face got red. Francie knew they were making fun of his spats, and to save his feelings, she pretended they hooted because he was carrying a baby, and she offered to take Lori. He refused the offer. He knew as well as she did that they were making fun of his spats, and he was filled with bitterness at the narrow-mindedness of Williamsburg. He decided to put the spats away in the box when he got home, and not wear them again until they moved to a more decent neighborhood. Francie was wearing her lace pants and freezing. Whenever an icy wind blew her coat apart and went through her thin dress, it was as if she had no underwear on at all.
"I wish, oh, how I wish I had my flannel bloomers on," she mourned. "Mama was right. A person could get pneumonia. But I wouldn't give her the satisfaction of letting her know. I guess I'll have to put these lace things away until summer."
Inside the church, they preempted a whole front pew by laying Laurie full length on the seat. Several latecomers, thinking there was an empty seat, genuflected at the pew's entrance and prepared to enter. When they saw the baby stretched out over two places, they scowled fiercely at Katie, who sat rigid and scowled back twice as fiercely. Francie thought it was the most beautiful church in Brooklyn. It was made of old gray stone and had twin spires that rose cleanly into the sky, high above the tallest tenements. Inside, the high vaulted ceilings, narrow deep-set stained glass windows, and elaborately carved altars made it a miniature cathedral. Francie was proud of the center altar, because the left side had been carved by Grandpa Romilly more than half a century ago, when, as a young fellow lately come from Austria, he had begrudgingly given his tithe of labor to his church. The thrifty man had gathered up the bits of gouged-out wood and taken them home. Stubbornly, he had fitted and glued the scraps together and carved out three small crucifixes from the blessed wood. Mary gave one to each of her daughters on their wedding day, with instructions that the crosses were to be passed on to the first daughter in each succeeding generation. Katie's crucifix hung high on the wall over the mantelpiece at home. It would be Francie's when she married, and she was proud that it had come from the wood of that fine altar. Today the altar was lovely with banked scarlet poinsettias and fir boughs with the golden points of lighted slender white candles gleaming among the leaves. The thatched creche was inside the altar rail. Francie knew that the tiny hand-carved figures of Mary, Joseph, the kings, and shepherds were grouped about the child in the manger as they had first been grouped 100 years ago when they had been brought over from the old country. The priest entered, followed by the altar boys. Over his other vestments he wore a white satin chasuble with a golden cross on the front and back. Francie knew that the chasuble was symbolic of the seamless garment, supposedly woven by Mary, that they had removed from Christ before they nailed him to the cross. It was said that on Calvary, the soldiers, not wishing to divide the garment, had cast dice for it while Jesus was dying. Absorbed in her thoughts, Francie missed the beginning of the Mass. She picked it up now, following the familiar Latin in translation. "To thee, O God, my God, I will give praise upon the harp. Why art thou sad, my soul, and why dost thou disquiet me?" chanted the priest in his deep, rich voice.
"Hope in God, for I will still give praise to him," responded the altar boy. "Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Ghost. As it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be, world without end. Amen," came the response. "I will go unto the altar of God," chanted the priest. "To God, who giveth joy to my youth," came the response. "Our help is in the name of the Lord, who made heaven and earth." The priest bowed and recited the Confiteor. Francie believed with all her heart that the altar was Calvary, and that again Jesus was offered up as a sacrifice. As she listened to the consecrations, one for his body and one for his blood, she believed that the words of the priest were a sword which mystically separated the blood from the body. And she knew, without knowing how to explain why, that Jesus was entirely present, body, blood, soul, and divinity, in the wine in the golden chalice, and in the bread on the golden plate. "It's a beautiful religion," she mused, "and I wish I understood it more. No, I don't want to understand it all. It's beautiful because it's always a mystery, like God himself is a mystery. Sometimes I say I don't believe in God, but I only say that when I'm mad at him. Because I do. I do. I believe in God and Jesus and Mary. I'm a bad Catholic because I miss Mass once in a while, and I grumble when at confession I get a heavy penance for something I couldn't help doing. But good or bad, I am a Catholic, and I'll never be anything else. Of course, I didn't ask to be born a Catholic, no more than I asked to be born an American. But I'm glad it turned out that I'm both these things." The priest ascended the curved steps to the pulpit. "Your prayers are requested," intoned his magnificent voice, "for the repose of the soul of John Nolan."
"Nolan, Nolan,"
sighed the echoes of the vaulted ceiling. With a sound like an anguished whisper, nearly 1,000 people knelt to pray briefly for the soul of a man only 12 of them had known. Francie began the prayer for the souls in purgatory. Good Jesus, whose loving heart was ever troubled by the sorrows of others,